It seems like a very, very long time ago that either Miss Butler or Miss Miranda led my classmates and me through the differences to be found between parables and metaphor and analogies and allegories and similes and all sorts of figures of speech and the way we can use language to communicate ideas. Now, you might think that wandering down memory lane to English lessons of days gone by would have nothing to do with understanding today's lesson from Scripture. But if you were to think that, you would be wrong. For today, we need to look at the difference between parables and allegories if we are to get our arms around this lesson. The story, of course, is called a parable. We have it right there in Matthew. And yet, if you listen to the second part of the lesson that John read, with the explanation of all of the different elements, it sure seems like an allegory. A parable is meant to have one big point. It's meant to grab you by the lapel and shake you and get your attention and communicate an idea in a way that will surprise you, change your perspective, help you gain a new and deeper understanding. Allegories will have all sorts of different kinds of ideas or symbols or events that are mapped out through the narrative. And you can unpack the story piece by piece and say A represents one and B represents two and so on. The church, not surprisingly, given the text, has often understood this passage as an allegory, even though we are told Jesus was preaching in parables. And there is some value in doing that. But if we read it as an allegory and not as a parable, then, please forgive me, we risk getting lost in the weeds. There's one big idea here. An idea that Jesus wanted his hearers to grasp, that the early church felt its members should grab onto, and indeed an idea that is relevant today for you and me. We see this emerge through the text itself and the way this gospel was constructed. This is it. The disciples have been traveling around with Jesus. They've been listening to him preach. By the time this story takes place, his ministry's been going on for a while. Did you notice where he was teaching? He wasn't in the synagogue anymore. He'd moved on from places of organized institutional religion. People had been hearing him, and some people had responded positively, and others with fear and hostility. The word's getting around. People are hearing about this new message about God's kingdom unfolding in unexpected ways. They're checking out Jesus. Now, the disciples at this point are totally convinced. Of course, what Jesus has to say is true. Of course, God is coming and fulfilling God's promises. Of course, the kingdom is breaking out. They see it around them. But what they don't quite fathom is why, if they recognize the truth in everything Jesus is saying, why doesn't everybody else? Why are people not getting the message? Why are people scorning Jesus and angry with him? Frustration can begin to build. Despair emerge, and Jesus knows this. So too, the early church. In Matthew's day, The early Christian community was faced with hostility and persecution and opposition. And this was post-resurrection. People thought Jesus has been raised from the dead. God has conquered despair and darkness. And yet nothing seemed different. The Romans were still out there. People were still being hounded, abused for what they believed. And so the early church picked up the message and shared it. Jesus offers different ways that seeds can fail. And then the church in Matthew offers explanations of what that might mean. Not to say these are the exhaustive ways or possibilities that faith can fail, but to give people a spectrum of ideas. So sometimes there is just no room for faith to take root. That's the stony path. Sometimes people hear the word. It sounds good. They come to a service. They get involved in everything. And then they start finding out that the life of faith is not only designed to feed the soul, but also has requirements and expectations and makes demands on people. And so they might fall away. And then there's the third possibility, the one that I think is especially pertinent to us in the church today. The potential for faith is there. It is real. The roots can go deep. But there are other claims on our time and our hearts, our priorities. And it's easy for us to think about some of the existential or apocalyptic claims that might be out there. In Matthew's time, of course, there was the very survival of the church. We can think about some of the issues that Paul had to deal with. That old church favorite, fornication, licentiousness, backstabbing, jealousy in the church in Corinth and other places. Those are claims on our hearts. But there can also be estimable, worthy claims that challenge the church. Other causes we want to support and give our time to. And rather than saying that God is the lens through which we see our lives, we instead say God is going to be one of our six priorities. And I'll divide my time between God's work and the hospital's work and the school's work and the building project's work. And sometimes we're engaged with God and then other times not. Jesus wants his followers, he wants you and me to know that there is a danger. Our faith can be crowded out. Don't let it happen. Jesus warns his disciples. Matthew warns the church. Don't let it happen. Don't let the weeds overrun the garden. Don't let them kill the seeds. Because there is a tremendous payoff that can be realized when the seeds take root and grow and flourish. The harvest can be amazing. Remember, there's no fertilizer back in the first century. Not like we know. No genetically modified crops. No university extension system to help farmers. A good crop might have a tenfold yield. But 30, 50, 100? This is miraculous, remarkable stuff Jesus is talking about. If we persevere, if we hold on to the promise, if we focus on our faith, we can enjoy this kind of bountiful harvest. Of course, this doesn't mean that we should start looking at our metrics and think, oh, if we're all good and faithful, we will have a 30-fold increase in worship and attendance. This isn't a quantitative number that's put in front of us. It is qualitative. This is about the depth of experience of God's love and God's power and God's saving grace. Many of us have seen that in this church and other churches where faith has transformed lives, where it has saved lives. It's an amazing harvest, an amazing bounty. And not surprisingly, there can then be a quantitative payoff, because when people see what a difference the church can make in the lives of people, they are drawn to it, not only because of the way it feeds people, but because of what it asks of people. People recognizing God's call, the most important work that needs to be done in the world. And so, like disciples, like members of the early church, they will respond. Like you, they respond. And they serve. And they witness. And they evangelize. Even if we in the UCC don't use those words. Anybody here who has a lawn or flower garden or vegetable patch has encountered weeds. And sometimes they're the really ugly, thorny ones, and you can spot those immediately. Sometimes they're pretty, like dandelions. But we all know the moment you pluck the last weed, another one is going to spring up. Weeding requires vigilance, and so too does faith. We keep plugging away. But we're capable of holding on to a big idea. We're capable of following through on it. Because we know that Jesus believed in the disciples. He believed in those first Christians in Matthew's church. And God believes in us. So let's go out. Let's spread some seeds. And let's see what happens.